page turners, and welcome to another exciting interview edition of Outside the Pages. I am Chaz Simons, your host, and I'm joined by my co-host, Poet Air, and Synesthetics, also known as Michael and Jack. What's up, guys? We're pretty excited. We've got the editor-in-chief and the writer-creator of Scales and Scoundrels, editor-in-chief of TKO, I should say, sorry, and the writer of Scales and Scoundrels, both volumes, that is, Sebastian Gerner, joining us on the show today. Very excited to have him here talking about Scales and Scoundrels, Volume 2, that comes out in just a few short weeks in July from TKO Presents.
All right. As your faithful editor, I am obliged to tell you that Zoom did drop for a moment in the beginning of the episode. So hopefully it's not too jarring. Let's hop right in.
It's like the squarest thing in the world is, I'm German originally. So I was raised between America and Germany, but I went to school there, studied Japanese language and history and culture, and I was kind of thinking about going back there and getting a job and writing a thesis about comics. But as you do when you're out of college, you start sending your resumes out. And a friend of mine, his name is Mornsack Fischershout, who's a wonderful editor at the time, was an editor at Vertigo, and who's Karen Berger's assistant editor, is currently also a great comic book writer, wrote.
The Good Asian is like recently, insane.
Good Asian, yeah. So he's fantastic. Yeah, I mean, Mornsack's an exceptional writer, and I'm excited that he's finally he took his time to write comics, but now that he's here, it's just like blowing everyone out of the water. But he was, my sister, I don't know how I actually met him. My sister went to school with a mutual friend. So anyway, he was the comic book editor in my life. Basically, I went to visit the editor, Vertigo offices once. So when I told him that I'd be coming to New York, he was like, you should send your resume to Marvel, because he knew I was a big fan of comics. So I did. And then I was in New York for an interview and they needed someone at the time. And I was willing to hop on a plane and, move over to New York where I had family. So it wasn't the complete kind of uprooting, that sometimes happens after college. But I took to the job. I loved comics. I had no idea what an editor does. And it was, a steep learning curve. but basically, at a place like Marvel or DC or any publisher that has, a staple editorial office, you are kind of like they're caretaker of the books. You're the caretaker of the characters. If you're dealing with Marvel and DC, you're this stable of grand characters. And you're also the advocate for the creators. You develop stories and ideas with writers and artists and put art teams together. And you're trying to make a splash, you're trying to, tell the most interesting stories with these characters that have been around for, longer than any of us have been alive and will be around for longer than most of us.
Yeah.
Probably all of us.
No, slowing them down.
Yeah. So you're kind of the connecting bridge between the marketing aspect of a comic book and the artistic aspect, which is, a very delicate and important balance, because comics have always been art, but have also always been a commercial product. And you're always kind of fighting that seesaw back and forth, which camp do we dip in, too much or too little? And then when you're freelance editing, which is what I started doing, which is, I don't know how many people are doing it, it's a very niche, but it's a job that's become more, I think, especially through creator owned books kind of being a lot more viable these days. That an editor is another, basically a co-creator whose job it is to make sure that everyone else does their job the best, who can always kind of be a little, I always try to be a little emotionally detached, not in the sense that I don't care about the characters, but that I'm not invested in whether they do, whether you go one way or the other. I really want it to just be the best, and you help your creators kind of just see all the options that they have in front of them, be that both narratively, story, but also, sales and marketing and packaging and design. And you're the guy that everyone asks, how are we doing this? I always liken it to that when you're a creator, your nose is really in the in the sandbox, basically. Like, you're really, really in there. And then the editor's job is to kind of hover just a little bit above that and be like, well, if we do it this way, you know, here are your options, here are the consequences and all those things.
So it kind of sounds like it's almost like a director, but less hands-on. More big picture.
Yeah, you could do the you could be like, you could be like a producer. You know, producers are producer, like, okay. what do they even do? Like, no one knows, but they have a huge, you know, influence on putting the team, like, you know, at a place like, again, Marvel and DC, where the editor is the one who hires, you know, like, there's a huge difference. If you take the same script, you know, from one great writer and give it to a dozen artists, then you end up with a dozen different comics depending on, you know, the direction that you go and the leeway that you're giving and the, you know, whatever, the budget and the time constraints that you're operating under. So it's a really, really creative position, editor. I think that if, you know, if anyone's interested in comic book editing, like, I think it should be done by more disciplines within comics. The majority of editors that I know are themselves writers. And I think that that's traditionally kind of, that's still kind of translated over from, you know, the heyday of Marvel and DC and, Stan Lee and Marv Wolfman, all these like great editors who were, you know, themselves mainly writers and then, you know, would find writers to do the writing for them. Maybe Stan Lee's not the best example, but
yeah, maybe like Jim Shooter or somebody. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But there's also like Cliff Chang, who's, you know, exceptional
phenomenal
artist of, was also
say, an editor. Back over there.
To go. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's a job that I think a lot of disciplines of comics, you know, would benefit in doing, like editing a book or editing anthologies, which is a big thing. Kickstarter is a different kind of genre anthology. So it's still, you know, it's a job with a pretty long history in American comics, especially. And now as editor-in-chief of TKO, well, I'm also like the only editor. I do all the editing. Right? I get the nice shiny title as well. It's exciting because I'm in a position again where I can kind of creatively guide a line of books by, you know, exploring, you know, different writers, different artists. And TKO is, of course, a publisher where we have a really enormous leeway in regards to the kinds of stories we can tell and with what kinds of authors and, you know, all up and down the kind of experience ladder where we're working with, you know, established pros, but also like giving a lot of really young new creators like a first shot and art style. Like I was always, I read a lot of different comics. Like I was kind of grew up reading a little bit of superhero stuff, but like a lot of manga and French, like kind of Franco-Belgian and fantasy comics, clearly where a lot of my love of fantasy came from. So it's cool to just be in a spot as an editor where you can just put great people together on a book and watch them do their best work.
That's a great way to start the episode. And for people that, especially listeners, aren't diehard comic book nerds, that's such a great explanation of what editors do in the comic book industry. So I really appreciate that. And I had no idea that you, edited some of, I'm a huge Rick Remender fan and those are some of my favorite books.
Yeah, I was going to say, you should have seen his eyes like went super, I mean, you did see it, but his eyes went super wide right when he
started with Black Science. And I was like, whoa. I love that book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love all those books, but
yeah, no, I worked with Rick is a pretty just his output is quite amazing. I learned a lot from just being his editor because for a while there we were putting out I think almost books like once a week. We were sending books to print and just like that pace is very unusual, you know, in creator-owned comics, like kind of
consistency
and the rapid development. It was good that I kind of came to that job out of Marvel because like Marvel DC, any kind of monthly comic book publisher, the workload is pretty high. Like you're in there a lot, especially as an assistant where, you know, well, stuff trickles downhill. It was funny, like after I left Marvel, I had a, just a part-time job in an office and, someone warned me, was like, this job is pretty hectic. It was also in publishing, it was fact checking for a travel magazine. And I was like, okay, I'll see how you do. It was like the easiest job in the world. I came in like, it's like, I don't know, weightlifting. If you're pushing like 250 and then someone's like, be careful, we're going to put 50 pounds on you. And we're like, yeah, I think I'll do it.
I like awesome. Picturing Unbreakable when he's just lifting, like no matter what weight is on there.
Yeah, exactly.
Came in, we're like, yeah, whatever project.
It just makes you think of Mark Gruenwald and you being like, do you understand the complexities and the continuities of the Marvel Universe that I have to deal with every week?
I don't envy that.
All the fun. That's pretty good.
Love it.
So yeah, I mean, being able to spin a lot of plates is definitely beneficial for an editor.
I thought it was interesting the way that you brought up the way that not only are you helping tell the story in the best possible way, but you're figuring out some of the marketing and some of that back end of what's going to make it sell well. And I've always found TKO's release model, the box set of all six issues all at once, or the full graphic novel, here you go, to be one of like the best things in the last couple of years to come out. Like, it's one of the most exciting, like, all right, cool, getting the whole thing. I don't have to wait like week by week, month by month. Was that, being editor in chief, being the sole editor, like you were saying, did you have a big hand in that decision? Was that like a cool, that Netflix model, the bingeable experience?
It was something that came together very, pretty much from the start, where when I was reached out to by our publisher, Sean, and his our co-founder and partner, Salvatore Simeone, the two of them were kind of asking around, talking to a lot of different people in comics. And I guess that I was one of the only ones who kind of laid out the complexity or the complexities of the direct market, just like the fact that the direct market is what it is. It's existed for, 20 to 30 years at this point. And no one, no matter how many new publishers we have, everyone kind of goes through it. It's the eye of the needle that the entire comic book industry in America kind of wanders through. And then I remember them, they were like, oh, do we have to do that? And I was like, well, you don't have to, but realize that you'd be the only company not doing it. And they're like, oh, that sounds awesome. I think let's do that. And I was just like, oh, it's like literally like finding a unicorn that also is wearing your favorite like football jersey or something. You're like, oh my God, it's both things at the same time. Because it's so rare to find people who are like actually willing to do things differently. And I've been thinking about it for so long, because the direct market, for all the reasons that I understand why it exists, it really, really benefits the biggest people in the room, the biggest publishers at the table. And my heart tends to, beat strongest for like smaller books or independent developers and creators and stuff like that. So finding a company that was actually willing to like put up a new way of doing it, and also like acknowledging that like the way people get stuff, get music and games and software, like it has to be more instantaneous. And comics are wildly popular, but if you look at the markets in which they sell like absolute crazy, which is manga and younger readers, like you're not going to the store every month, and you're especially not buying a phone book size thing and then giving your brick and mortar shop person a 5-digit code so that you can buy a book in 3 months. Like it's a pretty antiquated system, in my opinion. Again, understanding why it works. So with TKO developing, like you said, the binge release model, and doing all of our own distributing, all of our own order fulfillment, and just building that relationship with comic book shops, which took a while, but because we had a great deal and because we didn't want to cut, comic book shops out, we have a really, really great relationship with them. Over the course of, the first 2 or 3 years, I think we're in almost every shop in America at this point. And if you're listening and your shop is not part of TKO the network, you can just reach out to us at sales@tkopresents.com and we'll hook you up. And we just wanted to make it as easy as possible for anyone to buy our books, no matter where you hear about us, like on Twitter or on social, or we do, advertising and actual advertising. Sounds crazy, but just trying to expand the market, because it never seemed to be about the stories that comics are telling, which is phenomenally rich and diverse, range of stories and people creating them. And it really, to me, was always like, how do we get more people to actually find the books? And we've had some great successes with that so far, with a lot of crossover hits and comics that are finding an audience in places that, aren't necessarily the comic book store, but might actually drive people to them at some point.
No, that's
really awesome. First off, I've been saying for a long time, I always think that for like you know, original properties. There's nothing quite like comic books. A lot of stuff with movies that you see these days, or even video games, are kind of a story been told before and then reiterated. And they do that in comics, but also comics have such a wide range of original stories that are very deep and rich that you couldn't get anywhere else. I mean, I really appreciate you trying to get those out to anyone. People understand that comics are more than just superheroes, which even my wife, who I'm a huge comic fan, she just thinks of superheroes. She sees all my comics. Most of them don't have superheroes on them, but just her immediate thought is superheroes. Yeah. So, I mean, it's really great to try to break through that, you know, preconception of comics. And one thing about your model I want to say real quick about what you said, it's so exciting for me each year because I always get the books of when you guys announce who's going to be the creators on your next wave and then getting to pre-order them. I'm always really pumped each year. It's always an exciting time for me. And I can't wait for the announcement this year.
I'm so stoked for this year. I'm really excited. So it's one of my favorite, like, I know I say this every year, but like this year I'm a very hard person to please with my own work. And this year I'm like,
that's awesome.
All right. That's a good endorsement right there.
Yeah.
I'm digging it.
Yeah, that's good stuff.
And to bring up now, I want to bring up Scales and Scoundrels, which we read both books. We had the awesome opportunity to read the second book, which is about to be released, but hasn't been released yet, Festival of Life. And the first book, Where Dragons Wander. I know we all had a lot of fun with this.
Phenomenal.
So much fun.
Wow.
Super fun. They're both, you know, long. They're almost like full series, but they're such fast and engaging reads that you almost want more. Mm-hmm. Like when I started reading it, I imagine like a lot of YA books or younger youth books are more, you know, they're around like 100, 150 pages, but each of these is a good amount of story, 280 pages. And it's all really like, it's really great for the characters. You get to see them develop. You have a great cast with Lou, Aki, Koro, and Dorma, who are kind of our main central party, as you'd call it, if you're in like Dungeons and Dragons. Mm-hmm. And like I said, it was a warm blanket for me. Like I grew up with Robert Jordan books, which I know you mentioned Franco-Belgian, which I can see all that, but also a lot of it reminded me of Robert Jordan as well, reading The Wheel of Time when I was younger. Yeah, I got a lot of those vibes, and it was definitely, like I said, a warm blanket. The first question I want to ask, and I know these guys have other questions, is besides Robert Jordan, was there any fantasy writers or anything you read as a child? But I'm guessing the Franco-Belgian comics, as you mentioned, but any kind of just prose that you read that kind of inspired the story or where you got kind of the inner workings from?
I have to actually earmark that. I didn't actually read a lot of Robert Jordan. I read The Wheel of Time.
The first one
in German. Yeah. No, it was, I read very few, like, actually that's not true. There's a big, I guess you would call it YA literature, but when I grew up in the like 80s and 90s, there's a big, you get these giant books in German. There was this one author, his name was Wolfgang Holbein, and he would write these kind of, 800-900 page, like just behemoths, you know, when you're a kid and you just read, you know, like giant books. And they were always like fantasy. A lot of them were like fantasy adjacent. They were very like kid finds a hidden world and does something. And, you know, it's very classic. So I read those and I liked those a lot because they weren't like, it wasn't until well a couple of years later that I read The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings. And I think that those were the only two that I really like recently started reading. The Chronicles of the Black Company, which is enjoyable. And of course I read the George R. R. Martin books when,
me and Chad are big fans.
I'm sour.
Yeah, I'm
on
the sour on that
either. It's okay. We don't have to. Yeah. A fan.
That's as long a story as the one he tends to be writing. I think with Scales, there's a literary influence, but of course, you know, it was kind of like when I started talking with Galad, the artist, and he, we decided that we wanted to develop, you know, like a comic together. He sent me some sketches of what would become the main character of Lavander, who didn't have a name yet, but he knew that this is the character. He just wanted to draw this like scruffy haired, kind of like roguish, you know, like chaotic energy adventurer. And, you know, wouldn't it be cool if she could turn into a dragon? And I was like, oh, that does sound pretty cool. So let me, and we started talking, and this was in the, right around the time that like fantasy became popular again with stuff like Game of Thrones, but it was all very, and The Witcher, but it was all like very violent and very like, look, it's fantasy, but there's like violence and everyone's a racist and there's boobs everywhere. And it's like, okay, that's
grimdark.
Yeah, it's like grimdark. I'm a huge fan of like of grimdark. Like I read the Warhammer Fantasy Codex books just for fun.
All the fantasy elements just make it the worst place to live.
They're pretty rich, so yeah, that's a good way to go.
Extremely rich and a ton of fun, and I love the art, and I just love the over the topness. But I think when it came to scales, we talked about the kind of books and the kind of fantasy, and him being French and me being German, clearly not the same, but culturally, we had access to a lot of the same stories and a lot of the same, I guess, like the same flavor of fantasy, like fantasy that really feels like magical and adventurous. Wow. And like you want to,
beautiful,
like a world that you actually might want to visit, as opposed to like who would want to go to Westeros? Like,
yeah. They always showed the city and it was like grime and dirt everywhere. Everybody's dirty, like, and stuff. And it's like, ugh, no, thank you.
You would have a terrible time.
Yeah.
And then, so basically like, yeah, exactly. It's just like, not only, you know, are you poor and sick, but like it's a magical disease, and also the money, you know, summons demons. And it's like, well, that's, you know, so we were like, let's try something different. Let's try like making a comic. Well, first of all, making a comic like this, which hadn't really been, you know, done with Galad's art style, which, if you know anyone who's listening who hasn't seen it, is very, very vibrant. It's his first.
That's crazy. I did not know that.
Really?
An animator. Yeah.
I was about to ask how y'all hooked up, and I figured he had to have done something like in France, or like something that you saw and were like, I got to get this guy. But that's even more incredible, man. No.
Yeah, completely out of the blue. I was interviewed for a French website, comic blog. That's what it's called, comic blog. And they interviewed me about my editing work, which was very nice. And he read it, and he had been working as a character designer and storyboard artist for different animations and video games, and he was interested in getting into comics, so he reached out. And you know, luckily I read all the mail that kind of comes in, because people will like, you know, send you like, here's 500 pages of script I wrote, will you read it and turn it into a comic? And I'm like, but we
save for later.
We started up a conversation, and I don't know, he's such a sweet guy, and we immediately kind of like realized that we were on a good wavelength. And I had also been, I mean, it also, you know, looking at the kind of books that I was editing, it's all, you know, very adult, pretty violent, kind of, you know, crazy high concept stuff. And I really felt, as I started developing scales, I was like, oh, this is actually, I kind of miss stuff like this. You know, it's kind of like, if you're on a mad binge of like great rated R movies that you're just like really tearing through, and at some point you're like, I think I'm going to put on a Pixar or like a Disney film and just like
break this up a little bit. Yeah.
A little bit, right? You know, like just, I mean, that's our high watermark, is that we wanted something that clearly, you know, genuinely all ages, and that you can give, you know, to kids and have them kind of just love the fantasy, but then also, you know, write it hopefully in a way that adults who do read it, and a lot of adults read young adult. It's like the entire second audience of young adult literature is just adults, which is why it's basically just adult literature. But to craft something like that, you know, I think in the second book you were leaning a little bit more into that, because the idea was always that the characters would kind of age a little bit with the audience. If we had kept the book going in one continuous loop, you know, you would start maybe reading at age 8, 9, and now you would be about 14 or something like that. So the characters would start having different problems and everything like that. So, and you know,
that's a really cool concept, you know, to see them grow. And then with the audience, I'd be excited to see them get older and older in the series. I was definitely going to say, Sebastian, that how you described like why you wanted to write this is literally how your book hit me. I have a young baby. I've not had much sleep. Now I was just reading all indie and like pretty dark and depressing stuff. I have this habit of like being drawn to stuff that's kind of, you know, sad and doesn't have happy endings. And then I was like, I need something light, and ended up reading these and getting back into Marvel, because I was like, I need to read something a little bit more vibrant and fun, which Yeah, it's great to have these books because, you know, a lot of, like you said, with the fantasy, the grim kind of fantasies, it's harder to find those. Sometimes it's nice to have this available for everyone.
Yeah. That's fine because I'm totally like that too, where I think like when Scales came out, everyone who knows me was like, really? This is the book you're making? And I was like, oh, you know, give me a chance. I'm complex. But then I did The Devil's Red Bride, which is like, you know, kind of like pigeonholing myself.
I love that book.
Like, all right. Let me give you the grimmest possible thing. Thank you so much. Yeah, that was a ton of fun to make.
Yeah, that's the kind of stuff I was reading, like our best of the years last year during the pandemic, which is funny, like me and Chaz's list, his was all bright and vibrant, and then mine was all just depressing, and I was like...
You could tell where I was escaping to. Anything that's fun to read.
You should follow Chaz's lead in this dark time. I was just reading really dark and depressing things.
That's two ways of coping, equally valid.
Yeah. One of the things that I also really enjoyed about Scales was the sort of blend. It's I want to say it's like mid fantasy kind of. It's not so intense. The world building is like incredible, and all of the characterization is like done excellently. Like it's explored through situations like just beautifully. But never did I feel like I had to go back and try to figure out what some word was or some, sometimes high fantasy stuff can get a little bit too like specific. And if I'm not paying as much attention, I lose it. But this is that perfect blend for me of like, oh, I know that it's a rich fantasy world, but the grounded parts, the humanization of the characters is so rich. Like I loved it.
I'm really glad to hear that because that was another thing that Galad and I wanted to, I don't know how to explain it. Like we didn't really know where everything was going to go. We just kind of loosely described the types of stories that really spoke to us and that, you know, 20, 30 years into our lives, we were still resonating. And it wasn't really like the lore books or like, how does the magic work? Like those are all things we kind of wanted to stay away from. Like I think Galad was the one who brought it up. He was like, when you read The Hobbit, specifically The Hobbit, not The Lord of the Rings, which is a lot more, you know, that's when Tolkien hadn't like mapped out every language and every song and all these maps. He was like, think about like how you just knew Gandalf was a wizard. That's all you knew about him. And he could do magic, but you had no idea what that meant.
Totally.
And it created this cool sense of like, I always want to have the reader doing a little bit of the work in their head, you know, so when we're describing a place or when you're reading about, you know, a little bit of the world building, like you can like kind of draw upon the reader's brain to do a lot of the rendering of what that actually looks like. And it'll always be a million times better, you know, than anything we can technically come up with. So while we have plans for a lot of the world, is actually like places I know we'll never actually go because I think it just sounds cool or it's great to let the reader, you know, just think about what that place looks like or who those characters are.
Yeah.
And not to explain too much because I found myself getting lost in fantasy books where the writer is clearly so excited about all the ideas they have that they forget to tell a story with them. It's just like, and then it does feel like reading the Warhammer Fantasy Codex where it's just like numbers and lore, you know, where there it makes sense because they're trying to bring life to like these inanimate plastic objects that you're, you know, shuffling around on a board for hours at a time. But when you're telling, you know, especially fantasy stories, which require an entire world, an entire societies and religions, which is one of the reasons that, like, I think what you say is half fantasy is that I think we described it almost like a little bit post-fantasy, that it's like it has a high fantasy. Like if Rome was our, you know, Western culture's high fantasy origin, then we're like in the year 2000 now. We're like, we remember these things, but do we remember it very clearly?
You know, that's a beautiful way to put it. Because that like, I think was what I was trying to reach for. I didn't want to say post-fantasy because there's still very much like fantastical elements. But yeah, the comparison to like Rome and now definitely feels right for this.
Yeah. You find the ruins, you find the writings, you can kind of be like, well, I guess this is what they meant when they wrote this. But you know, can we, and that's a big part of the
first book.
spoiler alert. It's not a spoiler alert, but it's kind of like what we've tried to establish is that like every character is struggling with the system from which they come in some way with their society or their culture or their elders, just to really show movement within. I don't know, a lot of fantasy is like, we're born into, you know, this kingdom and everything's great and our children will also be here. And and we kind of wanted to also, it's, you know, for younger readers, it's always great to have some rabble rousers. And who better to rabble rouse, you know, some scoundrels and adventurers who are out causing trouble anyway.
Yeah, I love how punk rock Lou feels.
Yeah.
She's great.
She's totally
sassy, but with a heart of gold. I think, ancestral trauma is definitely great. Like a big theme in fantasy that just fits really well into the world and is told in a cool way where it's not like too dark like it sometimes can be when they go into that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But like still impactful.
It just gives you, it's like opera, it just gives you more more trappings to develop, you know, to like express daughter, father-daughter trauma or conflict or, you know. And in terms of dark, like, I mean, it's ironic because Dorma is the dwarf in the book is like literally afraid of the dark, which is, you know, very,
I love that.
Very shameful for a dwarf.
Goes against the grain.
But there's like there's a two-parter with her that I actually thought was quite dark in the sense that it touches upon, you know, some topics, but I think that's one of the wonders of Galad's art is that it allows you to tell stories that do deal with, you know, loss and tragedy and I don't know, just life not being great all the time. But he can express really, really complicated emotions in a way that I think are palatable to both children and adults. Where I was, you know, vaguely uncertain when we were telling those two, I was like, I don't know, this is a lot about like grief and about death and about like you're just like being angry at your parents because they see the world so differently from you, and everyone loves each other, but everyone also does damage to one another in a family. And I was like, ooh, this is a lot. I don't know if this is going to fit my all ages thing, but you know, well, you guys tell me if it worked out, but. When I saw Galad's artwork for it, I was just like, damn, this is good. And I have a lot of faith in younger readers actually being a lot more savvy and a lot more capable of dealing with things than adults. I think adults look at kids and are like, ooh, we have to protect them from everything. And I'm like, I think we should let them in on a lot of it because they're also in the world. So if they're not stupid, they know what's going on. And I think we need to give people context for how we interact and how we treat each other.
Yeah,
definitely. And I do agree that the art made it easily digestible for some of the darker themes that went along, especially in that arc, which was a really good one.
Thank you.
I also really like the just like the overall themes of the world and how like the different, you know, areas and characters all have like their have like a strong flavor of their own.
Cool. Yeah, it's kind of one of the characters to reflect, you know, their environments and then vice versa. When we go to, you know, we're going to different parts of the world, and it's always fun because you always get to design a whole new landscape. But then, you know, thinking what's the story we want to tell with that landscape? Like, why are we here as opposed to here's a cool place to go? Although that's also clearly one of the fun bits of designing a comic, of course, is what happens to artists. You know, just come up with all this great stuff.
To go back, when you're not explaining too much, I really feel like that is really shown well in the Den of the Wind, the first dungeon, because you could tell there's a clear, rich history, but there's not explaining, which it just has you go through these fun levels of this dungeon. Like, it just keeps going down and down, and there's more surprises, which I really enjoy, you know, with a complete lake basically at the bottom, which reminded me a lot of actually manga and stuff like that. A lot of manga I read, there'd be like a lot of things were inside of stuff, like a lot of older One Piece and stuff. They'd go into a place and then it would have many layers, then lead to like a whole hidden little world, which I really enjoyed that. And you really played a magic trick on me, because when I was first reading, you know, when Dragons Wander, I completely forgot the beginning. So when the Lou reveal came that she was a dragon, it actually really worked for me. And I was like, that's awesome. She's a dragon. I don't know why I didn't put that together. And like all the kind of hints with the dragons before then, it just came off really successful for me. And I read it all at once. Yeah.
Oh, I'm glad.
It was a shock, but like a good shock. And really the fact of when we get to the point where there's a council of Erdens and all these people who are humans but can turn into dragons, like that's just awesome. Yeah. And I'm excited to like see all those characters we meet on the council later on in the series and see their dragon forms. We've only seen a few, yeah, which I can't wait to see all of them.
Yeah, we're pretty coy with that. Well, I'm glad, first of all, that worked, because we realized, again, this is something a lot of Night Talks, that we wanted to get our characters into an adventure as fast as possible and not, like, spend, you know, an issue setting up the world and having you read all about the history and, like, here's a map of all the cities and, like, here's all this information you need to, like, ingest before you can, like, here's the Cliff's Notes, you know, before you can go see the movie. To just kind of like hit the road and have readers get to know these characters the way you would if you were on an adventure with them, which is like everyone, you know, first of all, they're also not like immediately friends. You know, they really have to go through some stuff together. And like Lou is a, you know, huge pain, yeah, in the butt at the start because she's just after what she's after. And then just playing with the fun of like the fantasy trope of like a party finding together is like, you know how hard it is to like find four people to decide to go do anything, especially like, totally, let's all put ourselves in mortal danger. Like,
just, yeah,
having fun with those tropes, you know, like ultimately getting to where you want to go with fantasy, which is a bunch of fun characters on a fun adventure where they have to learn to fight and have fun and save each other and learn something about themselves. But yeah, you know, that first seven issue arc is you know, it's a little bit longer for a reason, because we really kind of just wanted to take the time to, I don't know, it really always felt with working with Galad like this is the once in a lifetime opportunity to work with an artist that's fresh and this good and also this fast. He's so freaking fast, which as someone who, you know, makes comics for a living, like you usually don't get all three, which is good, nice, and fast. Yeah. You usually have to make do with two, but he is, again, he's a unicorn. So we were just like, you know what, let's shoot for the moon and let's do all the things that they don't tell you. They tell you not to do, like, oh, your first real comic shouldn't be your, you know, magnum opus. And I was like, I said that to people and now I'm actually not following my own advice. So,
but why not, you know what? Right? If it's good.
I rescind that advice. If your magnum opus is the thing for you, you should do it. But, you know, I mean, here I am, you know, it's taken me 5 years to get the book back to where, you know, I really wanted it to be, which is that first big, the two books that are out with TKO now are the first, what would have been the first 20 issues of Scales and Scoundrels, which is a, you know, I don't know what I was thinking at the time, but that's a sizable amount of books. That's longer than a lot of series are right now.
Yeah, that's an omnibus.
Yeah, that's a big old piece of book, you know, and it's, if you read, you know, you're reading book two, no spoilers, but like we're just getting warmed up, you know, like there's definitely a lot more fun,
yeah,
to be had.
There's
a lot of
questions.
Yeah,
too.
Fingers crossed, you know, I'm
yeah.
There's a lot more story to tell. And we're
without revealing too much about the second book, I really enjoyed just the culture and society of the Wandering of the Scarlet Sands, the Wandering City of the Scarlet Sands, which, mm-hmm, I thought was really cool. And then also just how it becomes kind of a mystery story for a little bit without revealing too much anything that happens.
Yeah.
I thought that was a really cool, fun change of pace. Was there any kind of like real life societies or cultures? I mean, I'm sure there's some you can obviously think of that inspired the Wandering City of the Scarlet Sands.
Mm-hmm. So the Scarlet Sands culture in general, how did that come about? The actual like look and feel of it was like, I read a little bit about like, yeah, the nomadic, you know, African tribes and Bedouins across the like the Middle East, kind of just nomadic peoples who, you know, took their entire way of life with them wherever they went. Mongolian culture was the same, where they would have, you know, they would set up camp, village, shop, whatever you want to call it, for, you know, some time, and then they would take it all with them. And of course, we extrapolated onto this, you know, on top of it, like, what if it was like a whole city that just breaks up tent, and like, if you oversleep, like, you come out, like, there's nothing left. But nothing too specific. Like, we wanted it to be, I wanted to depict an like idealized perfect society. And then again, not to give away the story, but like show how even in there's always a snake in the Garden of Eden, basically. Mm-hmm. But also maybe that snake has a reason. And to just play with that, you know, that's one of the things about scales is that I love to have the opportunity to turn, you know, a story and characters over and just kind of, you know, clearly have the, like the fancy tropes of good versus evil, but then maybe spend some more time because they are scoundrels. All good has an evil side or a dark side, and all light has a dark side, and vice versa. But yeah, I also really wanted to do, I'm a huge Tintin fan. One of my favorite Tintin volumes is King Otacus Scepter, where he is in, Tintin goes to this Eastern European, you know, make-believe country, but, the king's scepter is stolen and becomes this mad kind of dash. And I don't know why, but it's like one of my favorite comics like ever. And that was definitely like an influence. I was like, I'm going to try and do a little homage to this like mad dash, you know, to save a crumbling, cause it's purely, I don't know how it is in Tintin, but like the fact that the scepter is stolen, like that's not the end of the world, right? It's just this item, but it's the import that we place upon ceremony and pomp and like prestige that, is a different form of power. And another thing that Scales is about is like how power kind of, you know, even the smallest bit of power can kind of like transform or even pervert, you know, the pure spirit basically. So yeah, I'm describing this as like very heady. This is like a really fun adventure romp through a desert city with like a lot of color and a lot of characters.
The color tones are so great when we first get to the city, just the complete change when Lou realizes she has to go there, and all those reds, it was such a nice change up. I love that about the palette.
I really, really enjoyed the vibe of like the story before that, where she's in this like library tower on top of a snowy mountain, and that just felt like so rich and just like pure undiluted fantasy, you know, the giant library tower on top of the snowy mountain, and then there's a big battle on top of it. I can't get into, but it's very epic. And I guess I can say it's not spoiler really, like the dream spiders, and I don't know, the whole vibe of that story right there was just like so on point for me.
Awesome.
And then and then it totally does just kind of like completely flip into a new vibe when she goes to the desert with the city of the wandering sands, but it didn't feel jarring. It felt like a good contrast.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I'm glad for that, because that's exactly basically everything that's in the second book of TKO, which if you've read if you are a listener from the before days, the first two volumes from it that were released with Image are now collected in book one of TKO. So that's, you know, the first 10 chapters basically, or 10 issues. And the second book from TKO, it has the two-part Dorma story, which were the last two issues that we published back in the day in single issue form. And then it has all new content, which is a three issue arc and then a 5-issue mega arc. And that was always going to be the second year of Scales. So that's why the library arc is basically like almost like a refresher, you know, like the jumping on point, you know, imagine reading one of these chapters every month.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we really wanted to layer in like, okay, let's get back to the real, you know, let's get Lou's story is always going to be the kind of like gravitational, you know, core around which all of these other characters revolve, because we definitely wanted to like dip into side stories. Like, here's Dorma, and maybe we'll check back on Aki, and you know, we'll see what Koro's up to. But every couple of issues, we wanted to come back and be like, all right, now Lou is gonna take it all a step further. And because she's so chaotic, you know, every time she shows up somewhere, something's gonna happen. Like, it's just automatically trouble's gonna follow her, or she's just gonna start it, you know, for her own sake. And this would actually be the first time, again, no spoilers, but this was the first time that like trouble doesn't actually follow her. It's just that once she's there, it just starts, you know, it like is attracted to her, because that's just how she rolls.
I really enjoyed I was going to say the change of pace you do with Lou's adventures too. I'm a sucker for silent issues, but near the end of the first book, that silent issue with the guy on the beach and I want to call her.
Beat me to it.
The sea demon story was great. It was such a nice change of pace and so much story is told with no words in that. And it's kind of, it's a very, without spoiling, it's a very sad, but also kind of, still positive and vibrant story.
I thought it was wonderful. And thinking about what you're saying about how Lou, creates trouble, but that trouble, she seems to find herself in trouble sometimes, I think, more than it follows her. But her, in that sea demon story, I thought was really a good example of the person that she is, that we find more about. Yeah.
I think that was wanting to, first of all, I love a good silent issue. I think they're, always very challenging, and I was aware of the, the kind of the risk you take as a comic book maker, here's a full price comic, but we skipped on the words, and also to be able to convey, what I thought was a kind of a fairy tale, is there a lot of little Hans Christian Andersen in that one? But to convey all of that with no words and then have Galad, of course, having access to a wonderful artist like that.
Yeah.
But also, showing that Lou, who she is, because we introduce her as such a firebrand, pun intended.
Yeah.
But also it's just exciting as a writer to have a character that you can tell any story with, that like, why not have it be kind of like a detective story in the desert, or why not have it be, a really giant, big high epic fantasy, or why not have her go into a dream world where, none of the rules of even the fantasy world apply, and just, it's so freeing and so liberating to have a character that can do that. And then it's really odd for me to be like, this is what comics always were for me, is to enter these worlds where you can have anything happen, you're still telling a story, it's still grounded, and the characters, what they say and what they do and what they feel means something, and it's serious, but the situations into which you can throw them are incredible, and whatever what we want to do with it, basically. And to just have, the opportunity to do that for 280 pages is exciting. And, so I'm so stoked that the books are coming out again now.
Yeah. Me too.
Likewise, yeah.
Yeah. I really enjoyed that first volume, but the second, I think, really drives it home. Having not done the singles, I didn't realize that the Dorma issues that kick off book two were like uncollected at the time. And that seems like such a travesty, because like those two issues, I think I got like pretty welled up at. Like I was like,
Oh wow.
There's some stuff going on here. And then I'm not afraid to say it. I got a little teary eyed. There we go. Just come right out with it.
I'm glad. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those were the two that at the time when we had to end Scales a little prematurely, those were the last, like the last issue 11 and 12, the Dorma, that was the end of Scales. So that was I got teary eyed at the time because I was like, oh man, we're going to leave readers with this like kind of double whammy. But luckily, the way we had the ending planned is that it was, ironically, the issue, or not ironically, very fittingly, the issue is about how to deal with loss and moving forward through grief, like not ignoring it, not letting it define you, but also not letting it keep you from moving on. At the time, it felt like a nice little like, oh, readers, look, here's a comic that's kind of about the situation we find ourselves in.
Yeah, a little meta, of course, but like appropriate.
Unplanned meta, sometimes acceptable. It's like a little extra umami.
There we go.
But of course, we were sitting on like two or three more issues basically done, and I was just like, damn it.
right after this, we get some good stuff.
I was like, here, dear readers, you have to deal with loss. And of course, beneath the hood, I was just like furious. I was like, oh, damn it. How do we get this? We can't let it end here.
Right.
So, I'm glad to say that it took a while, but we're finally where we want it to be.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and that arc was awesome. And then it picks right up from there. And goes right back into the main story.
That's great.
The next big epic arc and just keeps moving forward. I'm excited to see what's to come after volume two.
Yeah. Well, plans are, you know, there's a lot of ideas have been written. Yeah, there's, we'll see. I'm really excited that these two books are out and, you know, we started shipping pre-orders now. And,
nice.
And you know,
very nice.
Still pre-order through tkopresents.com. Those will get shipped to you, you know, wherever. We can have your store, if you want to have your store pre-order them for you, they reach out the same way through tkopresents.com. And then the beginning of July will be in bookstores, Amazon, libraries, everywhere. So we're having a nice summer of the scoundrels. And hopefully, you know, we'll be far and wide. And then volume three is definitely something we want to be thinking about.
I know it's something that I'm already thinking about. I feel like, especially now that you talked about your love for Tintin, I almost feel like you could put Lou could almost be like a Tintin of this fantasy world. Like I will watch her adventures end to end. And when it gets episodic, even like when the in book one, when the first big arc ends and then we kind of go on the party parts ways and like we get to see some solo adventures and everything. Some of that was even just as thrilling and just as impactful. That's when that Sea Demon issue comes in. As the overall, like the storytelling was just as effective in some of those mini arcs as they were in the larger arc. So like I'm feeling that Tintin-ness of like, all right, cool. I picked up this volume. I'm going to just read this cool adventure. It's going to teach me a little something, like you're saying, about power and systems. Like, so like
Tintin, but like if there were actual changes to the characters in between. There's tiny changes in Tintin.
Growth.
But like
growth.
Captain
right, yeah.
There's a little bit of growth. Like Captain Haddock goes from being a captain to like being, you know, he inherits that giant castle. The idea with Scales was that we don't want to be afraid of having readers actually miss characters. Like I'm sure that people have their favorite characters and they're like, oh man, like when are they going to come back? But like we have plans for everyone, you know, well past, you know, the future that we can account for. But to really make it so that when characters come back into the book, that's like meeting an old friend. You're like, all right, where did we pick up? You know, and not letting, I don't know. It's funny. Like one of the greatest storytelling lessons I think I learned was when I read or reread Preacher, which is, you know, one of my favorite comics. And I was remembered reading Preacher as a teenager, as a kid, that it was about this great friendship, you know, about these three characters who love each other, Jesse, Tulip, and Cassidy. I went back and read it and I was like, they're only friends for two issues before everything goes to work. They don't like each other at the start, and then I think they're only, it's that one time where they take a picture of the classic picture that you flash back to at the end of the story.
Yeah.
And I remember, I was like, wow, this comic is so, it's so problematic. They all act like such monsters to each other, and it's such a, you know, but the effect that you walk away with is like, it's a comic about a great friendship. It's like, no, it's very much not.
These fun guys go looking for God. They find is inside all along or whatever. And it's like, nope.
Yeah, no, I mean, I forgot this like trauma and all these like, just how terrible they are to each
Cassidy
other.
Cassidy and Tulip arc is brutal.
Oh my God. Garth is just so good at like, I don't know. But it's like that. Like everyone's had friendships that are probably relationships that are probably more bad than good. But then,
water can't give them up.
You have this. Yeah, it's like it's just such a part of how you become. You know, like an adult is like having terrible relationships and not knowing how to express yourself and all those things. But the reason I brought it up was like it's a great example of not to let yourself. You as a writer, and also you as expecting the audience, like don't give them what they want too much, right? You want to keep things moving. You want to keep throwing, you know, like wrenches into the gears, and just to circle back to Lou, like that's why she's such a great character, because she can't sit still. Like you're never going to be in a situation where we're just kind of meandering in her awesomeness, because she's going to do or say something, or something's going to happen around her that's going to, you know, just absolutely annihilate any kind of tranquility that we established. Yeah. And then she has to boogie her way back out. And that's always just the most exciting part for me, is like thinking of new trouble she can get into and how she can get out of it.
I like that. Keeping it moving. That's pretty good. Yeah. Even the fantasy version of her in Dorma's mind was like, I could fly. And I was like, yeah that's Lou. that's big time.
That was so fun. Oh my God, I forgot about that. Yeah, no, that's great.
Those are my favorite part of stories where the wrenches are thrown. So I'm glad that that's kind of your process. Because I mean, I'm a Last Jedi stan. I love that movie. But even a few comics I've read recently that I thought I knew where they were going, I always seem to like them more when it goes completely in places I would have never imagined. It just gives me like an excitement. Yeah,
I will keep that up.
Yeah,
I also enjoy that even though there are like some darker themes that get introduced throughout the story, overall it's nice to read something and be like, okay, my favorite characters aren't all gonna die horrific deaths and like,
yeah, we don't
have their whole lives ruined and whatever, you know, around any turn.
We don't have a red wedding planned.
Exactly. There's like a little bit of, it feels like there's a little bit of a safety net there.
Yeah.
Save it for volume 5 or something. Like way down the
line. Huge refresher. Yeah, for something so that can be so captivating, you know, without having those really fucked up things happen that you'd expect out of a lot of stories.
There's no plan, you know, I would never take anything off the table, but it's not.
Yeah.
I don't get a perverse pleasure out of creating characters that people love and then taking them away. Like if it, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And when books or series do that, that then becomes kind of like what the books and series are about. Like even, you know, Game of Thrones, the books, and then like Lost, the TV show, like Walking Dead. There's one shocking death. They see it works and like, and that's just a show.
Every six.
Or who are you going to kill next?
Take somebody out.
Like you establish that no one is safe, but then people are afraid of making connections, right? Like, I'm not going to get invested in characters if they're just going to line them up and down. It's so funny because, like, that's what life is like. Like, we invest into each other and have, you know, emotions and fall in love and fall out of love and have children. But, like, spoiler alert, there's a red wedding at the end for all of them.
Yeah.
Getting too philosophical. But no, with scales, I always think that we wanted to be able to talk about loss. We wanted to be able to talk about stuff like death and losing friends or losing loved ones. But I'm more interested in the people who have to live with it, right? As opposed to like, ha ha ha, now they're dead. Like,
right.
I don't know. This was it was just something that was important to me. Like, I think characters should be free to live and to die, but I want scales to be more about life than it is about death, I guess. I mean, this is odd for, you know, for a comic that we want to have big scales and then have there be big stakes. But ultimately, well, first of all, there are fates worse than death, even in scales.
Certainly.
And secondly, it's always much more fun to just send these characters on an adventure. Well, you know, we took care to establish, and over the course of every couple of issues, we'll remind people that it's not all safe, right? That this is a real world with, not because we want to, like, shock or you know, kind of get off on killing characters, but it makes the danger just feel realer. And it also, I think, is important for me. It was important as a kid to read about death, not in a like exploitative way or like fetishizing it. But there's a great, this is actually one of the main fantasy novel influences. She's not too well known in America, but she's a Swedish author named Astrid Lindgren, who famously invented Pippi Longstocking, but also wrote a book called The Brothers Lionheart, which I'm fairly certain must have been translated at this point. And she's huge in her native Sweden, obviously, but she's also massive in Germany. So like every child of my generation, like in the 80s, grew up reading these books. And The Brothers Lionheart starts with, this is not a spoiler, this is a really, really weird way to start a fantasy novel, because the majority of the novel takes place in a fantasy world. The way the two brothers, the titular brothers Lionheart, get there is that the younger brother is ill and the older brother dies by jumping out of a window to save his brother from a fire. And as he dies, he says, "Don't worry, we'll see each other again soon." And then the younger brother dies and wakes up in this fantasy world, and his older brother is already there.
Whoa.
It is bonkers. Like, I thought about this scene, I was like, oh my God. Like, not only does the little brother, like, see his own brother die, but, like, he knows he's going to die soon as well because he is so ill. And I looked it up, and it was just like, where did Astor really come up with it? Like, why not just have them in the fantasy world? Why not just tell that story?
Yeah, reveal it later when we're used to it or something.
Yeah, like, no.
Peel it back or... But whoa.
It's crazy because she's still like, oh, this is the world beyond. Like, this is beyond the veil of tears, right? This is either heaven or whatever you want to call it. And then, of course, you know, bad stuff starts happening in this world. And there's a terrifying dragon in it. And the villain is really terrifying. And it's a great, great book. She's such a wonderful... That book and Ranya the Robber's Daughter are two, like, kind of quasi-fantasy books. And I remember reading... I think that came back when I was writing Scales. And I was like, there was a way that she... because she kind of front-loaded the book with death, the whole rest of the book felt realer, felt more dangerous. Like, we've already established that the world is all safe. So this adventure feels more taut, feels tighter. Of course, that we didn't do that. I didn't start Scales and Stalthrills with a scene where it's just, you know, here's a child. But so, you know, that might have been of the time. But yeah, ballsy move, Astrid. Hats off to you.
Yeah,
that makes you immediately interested in those books.
Yeah.
it's a really beautiful book, and it has these really beautiful art. The version I read, or the original version, had these beautiful ink paintings by I forget. I used to know her name, but also if you see this and like imagine me as like a 6 or 7 year old, or 8 or 9, however old I was. Seeing this, the dragons in that are a definitive like inspiration for Scales.
That's awesome.
I like to do homages too much, but if we ever get as far with Scales and Scoundrels as I wanted to, there's definitely a name I wanted to swipe from that book, The Brothers Lionheart. It's my favorite dragon's name.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
and I looked up those illustrations, and they are amazing.
Isn't it great?
Yeah, this dragon is looking wild.
Yeah.
Holy
moly. Hit me with the name one more time. I want to look at some.
The Brothers Lionheart.
Okay.
Yeah, the artist's name, at least I think, is Ilon and then Wikland.
Oh, yeah. Ooh, wow.
Really cool.
Yeah, the black and white drawings in this are insane. The one I'm looking at right now. That is awesome.
Fantastic.
Very, very cool.
That's crazy with the internet now. I was like, oh, if I only had the book somewhere in my library.
I'll go check it out at the library later.
I can't vouch for the translation, but it's a really great book.
The audiobook is free on SoundCloud, which I just
found out
as well.
All right.
Everyone get it. Yeah, everyone that's listening,
everybody who's listening, if you haven't already, go pre-order Scales and Scoundrels Volume 2 from TKO Presents, or from your local LCS if they're a TKO shop. Make sure you grab the Volume 1 also, because it's really, really good, and you deserve to treat yourself, listeners. So get both of these volumes. And then do the other stuff that we were just talking about.
Yeah.
I also selfishly implore you to buy these so that we can read more.
That's it.
Please.
That they make more so that I can read them.
I'm itching for volume 3 or 4 already. Yeah.
Absolutely. You guys will be among the first to know when it happens.
Woo.
Well, thank you. We definitely appreciate that.
Yeah.
And definitely any projects in the future, Sebastian, just, you know, you have my email, let us know.
We'd love to have you back on.
Oh. I want to thank you again for coming on. We had a blast. You taught me a lot about stuff I didn't even know. I knew most of the editing stuff, but now I know a lot more about fantasy books I've never heard about. And it's cool to see just your passion for the comics industry, which I really appreciate.
Thanks so much. I'm glad to see your saw your little baby there at the end.
Yes. Once you're a parent, real quick, just parent talk. Not only you have to worry about them, but I didn't realize I was so ready for the baby. But then the moment you have it, for me, I was like, oh my God, now I have to worry about this baby I love to the rest of my life. Like, you worry when she's sick. Like, I just didn't really understand how much I already am a warrior, but how much you're going to worry about your baby.
Something very different.
Yeah, it's so much different.
All right, guys.
It's beautiful.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Sebastian. Yeah, we'll keep in contact. Thank you.
Yeah, it's great talking with you, Sebastian.
Talk to you all soon.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah, thank you. Well, we want to thank Sebastian so much for coming on. We had such a blast with him. Once again, guys, make sure you either go pre-order Skills and Scoundrel Festival of Life on TKO, or go ahead and hit up your LCS. And you can also get Skills and Scoundrels Where Dragons Wander right now from either TKO or your LCS. These are both great books, and you definitely want them in your hands.
And if you're ordering on TKO already, grab Sebastian's short story, The Father of All Things, which was real, real creepy from that first round of TKO Presents.
It's really good, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. As always, I am Michael, also known as Poet Air. You can find me on Twitter at PoetAir33. You can find the show at Outside the with a zero. And then where can they find you guys?
You can find me on Twitter as well, at Chaz Simons.
And you can find me on Twitter at Sim_aesthetics with an X.
And in with the mood of the books, Let There Be Dragons. Chaz?
Turn the page, wash your hands.
Pages.